It is nearly 2 years since Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups attacked Israel. The October 7 massacre, which saw more than 1,200 people, mostly civilians, die, with 250 taken as hostages. Human Rights Watch says Hamas committed crimes against humanity that day in the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. And now a UN International Commission of Inquiry has said the Israeli government and military are committing genocide in Gaza. A deadline of today, Northern Hemisphere time, has been set for a Hamas response to Donald Trump's peace plan. Israeli attacks, as we've heard, are continuing though, despite its military being instructed to carry out only defensive operations. And Hamas hasn't mentioned key parts of the plan, agreeing to disarm and to playing no further role in the governance of Gaza. Mike Seawright has been a regular guest on Sunday Morning ever since the war in Ukraine began. He's been on the ground there, often in dangerous situations, distributing aid. Mike is the former Auckland investment banker who walked away from that life and his yacht and decided to find a new purpose by founding the New Zealand charity Relief Aid. It's been in action during the conflicts in Syria and in Gaza, where its workers have been killed by Israeli shells. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jim.
We find you in Canada right now, of all places. Is this because you have Canadian partners you work with?
Yes, Jim. It's not the geese that are currently flying over us at the moment south for the winter, but we're very lucky here. We've started a Canadian office. This is to essentially help fundraising. This is all provided by businessmen who give us cars and offices pro bono, and friends and directors of our new Relief Aid Canada who provide their chalet free. So it's pretty amazing we can come over here and do business and maintain our core effort in delivering aid in terms of where the money's spent.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. Can you remind us again, just briefly, of the sorts of aid you bring to people in war zones? I think in Gaza, this includes safe drinking water, doesn't it?
Yeah, Jim. Relief Aid's been working in Gaza since the start of the war, now 2 years. We started with food and water at the beginning. In fact, at one point we were bringing food across the border from Egypt, but with the blockade of Gaza and the shutting of the Egyptian border, the Rafah border, we moved solely to delivering water inside Gaza because we could source the water from inside Gaza, we could source the trucks and the staff from within Gaza, and therefore we were not subject to borders that were closed. And what this has allowed us to do is, you know, get a donation here in New Zealand and then translate that the next day into water, which many aid agencies, unfortunately, because of the blockade, are not able to do.
Yeah. Yes, your team, you sent us an email, or your team sent us an email with a quote in it from Ahmad, your team leader on the ground in Gaza, who said, imagine, I'm quoting, imagine your heart being broken every single day for 715 days. How would you survive? I want to wake up, but this nightmare repeats itself every single morning. Can you, gee, what a thing to say. Can you tell us what your team has to go through, how they manage to operate, please?
I think we can generalise that into all families in Gaza because our team are just living like everyone else there. Is exceptionally difficult. They have to deal with the practical reality of life, and that's to find water because water doesn't get supplied to houses anymore. They have to find somewhere to live because most houses indeed have been destroyed, so they've been displaced multiple times. They have to somehow look after their kids who quite literally are waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares and the terrors, telling their kids that the slamming, the bombing, I should say, outside is in fact the slamming of the door or someone knocking on the door when in fact it's bombing and airstrikes around them. So this is an exceptionally difficult place to live. And then they go to work. And how they are able to manage and balance keeping their families alive and keeping their community alive with water is just a gigantic feat I'm in awe of. I'm so proud of our team in Gaza.
You've lost people there. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, I was reflecting on the last couple of years, Jim, and we have lost eight staff in our northern team and two injured. Our entire northern team doesn't exist anymore because they've been killed. From a humanitarian perspective, from a leadership, from a personal perspective, it carries scars, and I'm not losing family members, I'm not losing relatives, I'm not losing sisters and brothers and aunties and uncles like our team in Gaza, and yet it is extremely difficult.
And we can only imagine at the difficulty. Can I ask you some questions that are in people's minds or you see them raised in media? Does Hamas interfere with relief supplies, as the Israelis claim? I read in the New York Times the other day that Hamas seems to have appropriated, commandeered aid, not from the UN or the big American GHF operator, but from some of the smaller organizational donors. And if true, I wondered if that has affected you or whether you've heard about this.
Well, we have not been affected in any way by Hamas or any of the other armed groups inside Gaza. So I can categorically say we've lost nothing in that regard. But it is common knowledge that aid appropriation has occurred inside Gaza and that Hamas has done that in some instances. What's interesting, because, as much as we work on the ground in Gaza, we don't see everything, of course. We're focused on our water deliveries. But what was interesting a few months ago is that a US report indicated that while Hamas had appropriated aid, this was not systematic. And what it was, in fact, is a combination of armed groups and criminal gangs conducting theft. Specifically, the stuff I've seen, it was on the media, of food coming across the border into Gaza. So yes, it does happen, but is it systematic? Not according to a US report, at least.
Do ordinary Gazans express resentment towards Hamas? I mean, there've been protests. How numerous the dissenting voices are, I don't know. And I do know you're apolitical, but you have a team in Gaza communicating with you all the time, and you must get some sort of sense of what they think too.
Well, one thing's for certain, Jim, is our team and the community as a whole, they want this war to stop. They are not in support of anyone who continues it. They simply want the killing to end. Do people in Gaza support Hamas? Presumably, yes. Do we see that as a widespread phenomenon? Not according to what our teams tell us, and not according to what we see on the ground, because the families in the middle are the ones bearing the consequences of the actions of the military groups, both the Israeli Defense Force and armed groups like Hamas.
A senior Hamas official has told CNN it's been a golden moment for the Palestinian cause, and certainly big countries, as we know, have joined the move to recognize Palestinian statehood. But a personal question, do you ever despair that it takes the ghastly slaughter of men and women and children to achieve awareness? I imagine this is something you never get used to.
Jim, I've worked in war zones for 20 years. Is it worth it? I think this is a question for the people of Gaza, but certainly for our own team who have lost homes, who have been displaced multiple times, who, as we saw recently, one of our team members' auntie and uncle, relatives, I should say, 3 generations killed in a single airstrike. and where the family were taken to the hospital where the mother, a doctor, received all of them. I don't know. This is a question for the people who are bearing the brunt
I don't know.
of.
I don't know how you're. I didn't mean to interrupt because that's such a chilling thing you've said. I don't know how your people, though, managed to do that work in the face of all of this.
I can tell you, I wake up angry, about what's happening to families in Gaza. And I get left with two choices: to remain angry or to take action. And I am lucky we've got an incredible team in New Zealand, here in Canada, and also, more importantly, on the ground in Gaza, that allows us to channel this anger into helping other people. People may be dying from bombs, but we're keeping up people alive with water. And this does a lot. It doesn't fix the mental strain that comes with this job, but it does a lot to alleviate it.
Of course. Mike Seawright from Relief Aid is talking to us. I assume you stay in close touch with your people in Ukraine. And 3 months ago, Russia was more or less winning this war, and now it seems that it's not, especially with Trump's about turn and the prospect of Ukraine getting long-range missiles and so on that might cripple oil and gas inside Russia. But there are no golden moments there either. There never have been. Your people are still busy on in Ukraine. You've been on the ground there and at risk yourself personally. What's the story with aid in Ukraine now?
Well, Ukraine's a slightly different situation to Gaza, of course. Gaza continues to have reasonable public attention around the world, sometimes going up, sometimes going down. But the problem with Ukraine in terms of humanitarian action is that it's becoming a forgotten conflict. So, yes, our activities are continuing, our aid deliveries in Ukraine are continuing, but us ourselves and many of the other foundations that we see working in Ukraine are now struggling to find the funds to maintain operations there. And this is one of the reasons I'm here in Canada, is to drum up support, not just for Gaza, but for Ukraine as well, because the problem has not gone away. In fact, the attacks in Ukraine have only got worse. There is systematic targeting of cities now, well beyond the critical infrastructure that we've seen attacked in the past. And this is terrible because this continues to bring terror to a population in Ukraine that, like Gaza, simply want peace.
Yes, these are terrible wars for the reason you've just described, aren't they? So you'll keep on doing this work, obviously. Just to reiterate that point, you've been on the ground. You've been evading danger, not in Gaza, but Syria and Ukraine. And I began to ask you this before, it must take a toll on you as well. So it's that sense of purpose, because you seem to be expanding relief aid, it's that sense of purpose that gets you through.
Yeah, well, after Canada, I'm heading back into Ukraine, and I was in Syria a few months ago. I think we feel, and we're lucky to have supporters who also feel this. We feel that where there's a problem, where there's a humanitarian need, it's our duty to do our very best to serve that need. It's not without its own challenges. If I look at my own situation, long periods away from family, I would freely admit, although on the ground, it doesn't seem to affect me too much, but when I'm out of the countries, there is definitely an impact of 20 years of war zones and continuing to visit places like Ukraine and Syria. They take its toll. But who are we to stand aside when our teams, who not only have to experience these attacks but actually live permanently in these war zones, who are we to stand aside when they continue to serve themselves? I'm humbled by the people we work with who have a choice in some cases to leave, and don't and stay behind to serve their people. What small or ongoing consequences for the rest of us as we come and go from these war zones is nothing in comparison to the duty and dedication that we see from our teams in places like Gaza and Ukraine and Syria.
Yeah, that's the greatness of human nature, along with the its awful flip side, dark side, isn't it? Congratulations on the work, Mike. All the best for your current trip. And it's a pretty grim anniversary that we're remembering in a couple of days' time, isn't it?
It is, we are privileged to see the very best in humanity as well as the worst. And, you know, the things that keep me sunny, for want of a better word, you know, are just tiny examples, like hearing from our team that their neighbours shared food with them when they were hungry, they didn't have food themselves, and the humanity and hope that came from that. The little girl, I think you and I talked about this, I think last year, you know, the little girl who came up to one of our drivers when we're distributing water and clear, living in a camp here, clearly with little or nothing, and then offering her only biscuit to him as a thank you for serving the community with water. It's these lighter moments that give us some hope and confidence that humanity continues to exist in the very worst of places. And I'm privileged to see this.
Yeah, I remember that story about the little girl and giving the driver the biscuit. Mike, great to talk to you. As I said, all the best, and thank you for managing to give us the time in your trip to have a chat.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Have a great day.